Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. I mean, days
I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala, New York podcast.
You might recall back in August and the months leading up to August, me talking a lot about the retreat that happened at the Meditation Center, the Shambhala Meditation Center, in August. It was a week-long retreat. It happened, and it was led by Acharya Dan Hesse. He came from Colorado to lead this retreat at the New York Center. And you're lucky today because you're going to hear a talk that he gave at our weekly Dharma gathering during the week of that retreat. This was while the retreat was going on. That Tuesday was day four of this seven-day meditation intensive. The retreat participants were joined by the public for this evening talk, our regular Tuesday night weekly Dharma gathering, from which all of these podcast talks are taken. For this talk about meditation, mindfulness meditation. And it's really a great talk. Dan Hesse is an outstanding teacher. I'll tell you more about him. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is presenting its introductory weekend called Shambhala Training Weekend 1, Feel Human Again. This is happening the weekend of October 28th, and it's being taught by Lodro Rinzler, another regular contributor to the podcast. Anyone who's been interested, who's been listening, who has been dabbling in meditation and has been curious about going further, highly recommend this weekend of meditation. You can do it if you maybe think you can't meditate for a weekend. You can do it. There's a lot of great staff, great support, great faculty there to support you, and people really find that it's a profound experience. Go to ny.shambhala.org, click the link on the homepage, Feel Human Again, Shambhala Training, Weekend 1. And now, for this talk about mindfulness and kindness by Acharya Daniel Hesse. He has been a student in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition since 1971. He has been a longtime teacher as well, teaching all over the United States, South America. He is an Acharya, one of the senior most teachers in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. And he's just a great guy. And this talk is about, you know, meditation doesn't always feel that great.
Like, okay, here we are, now what? Here we are, now what? There's a tremendous amount of intelligence in putting ourselves in a situation where we don't have an occupation, a conventional occupation. And that really brings us to our topic this evening, which is, how do we understand this practice of mindfulness? What are we trying to achieve? How are we using this tool? Mindfulness these days is very much like yoga might have been 25 years ago, that it started out as this esoteric practice that was held within religious traditions for 2,500 years, Hindu traditions and Buddhist traditions and many other traditions. And it was really understood in that context completely. And now it has become something that is really, just in the last, what, 4 or 5 years, it's been something that's been understood to be accessible for everybody. It's seen as something useful and helpful. And a lot of people are curious about it and what it's for and how it works. And how we understand this tool has a lot to do with how we use it. And how we use it has a lot to do with how we feel about who we are. Mindfulness in the popular press and in some more naive situations is seen as a way of what? Fixing ourselves. taking our many bad qualities and repairing them. It's like a new paint job on an old car, except the car is your mind. That we're going to buff up how our mind is. We're going to take the dings out of our mind through mindfulness, through placing our attention on the breath. Or for that matter, and perhaps more commonly, we're seeing it touted as a way of optimizing our performance, that we become sharper, we become more precise, we can stay on task. And we're seeing this mindfulness used in many contexts, corporate contexts, and even military contexts, that we actually, at Shambhala Mountain Center, we received an RFP from the military about training military people in mindfulness. And indeed, any discipline that requires precision requires mindfulness, doesn't it? If you wish to, you don't have to be interested in spirituality. If you wish to learn to play violin or mandolin, I just inherited the mandolin I studied on. My first instrument I played was a beautiful Gibson mandolin. I was in ninth grade, and I was living with my grandparents, and I played this mandolin, and I just got it back, and I picked it up, and my fingers remembered the G chord, the C chord, the D chord. It was like right there. It was quite something. So the mind's interesting that way, and that's because when I was 14 or whatever it is, I put my full attention into where to place my fingers until I could actually just move them spontaneously. So anyone who's played an instrument understands this, that you can sort of noodle away while you watch, say, Law and Order or The Good Wife. Good Wife is good, and you're noodling away and playing your wrists. You're not learning anything, right? It's not mindfulness. But when you want to learn something and actually have it be close to you, it requires tremendous attention. So that's been the understanding that we've seen with mindfulness in many contexts. But it's kind of interesting. Does anyone feel claustrophobic in their work situation? Is that not something anyone has any experience of? Right? It's a little claustrophobic. You're sort of being driven to do more and more and more. This is very common in a lot of situations. And this idea of mindfulness is applied in an unhealthy way, in my opinion, is a way of making sure that you're just completely consumed with being on point all the time. And there's no sense of tenderness toward who we are and how we are. So mindfulness, when it's used strictly as a technique, as a tool, can leave us feeling distanced from ourselves, interestingly. It's like what Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche says, it's like self-surgery. It's like we're actually forcing ourselves into a kind of discipline that doesn't have any heart purpose. And by the way, you can do this, and you can be somewhat successful from that point of view. In other words, with a tremendous amount of determination, you place your mind on some task, like putting your attention on the breath, and you can achieve temporary results from that. You can be successful with that. But I'd like to explore a deeper way of understanding meditation practice that it doesn't have to do with forcing our mind into a particular technique, which results in a sort of continual struggle, that you feel that your wandering mind is sort of the enemy, right? And you're trying to be good and have your mind be on the breath, and you have all these thoughts and you have all these emotions, and your nose itches and your knee hurts. So you're constantly feeling that I have to struggle to not be how I am, but rather be in this idealized mindful state. And when that happens, something will take place, but it won't have much to do with how I'm feeling right now. That kind of approach, again, as I said, can definitely have results, but they're temporary results. It's definitely like a Band-Aid. It's like you could, it's like holding your breath, right? It, you say, shall we hold our breath and see how it goes? It's still pretty good. It's not a problem yet. No, I'm fine. I'm doing good, don't you think? This is a great practice. I don't have to breathe. It's fabulous. I worked a long time to be able to hold my breath. So you have that kind of relationship with your discipline, right? That you're very determined and it's quite tough, and you feel like on some level there's a whole thing about being a person that's undermining this perfected or this idealized state. Because guess what? We're full of thoughts and feelings and emotions, and how we are at any given time is quite a tender business, truth be told. Anyone have a cat? Do you love your cat? Do you love them? And do they sometimes crawl up into your lap? And when you then you pet them, do they purr? Sometimes they purr. And how do you feel about that? It's amazing. But it's not very mindful. There we go. It brings me into the moment sometimes. So that quality of tenderness, how we feel about ourselves, how we work with ourselves, that quality of gentleness and curiosity is a wonderful way to practice mindfulness and has a tremendous effect. In fact, how we feel about ourselves changes everything. So we could say that mindfulness is deeply caring about our mind and who we are, and that we meditate, certainly within the Shambhala tradition and other traditions as well, but my tradition, the Shambhala tradition, the reason we meditate is to reawaken our sense of worthiness and dignity and strength. And those things, a sense of worthiness, a quality of dignity, and a quality of inherent strength, those are seen as natural characteristics that everyone possesses. They're not acquired skills. This is a very important idea. That's why I say, if we regard ourselves as sort of a hot mess that needs to be optimized, that's going to be one meditative journey. If we regard ourselves as having inherent wakefulness, dignity, strength, and tenderness, and that the speed of our life and various things that have happened in our life have made it difficult for us to be with ourselves, we're shy to be with ourselves, and therefore we can't experience that inherent dignity, strength, tenderness, and wakefulness. Wouldn't that be a very, very different approach to working with meditation practice? That the technique could be very similar, but the understanding changes everything. So when we practice from that point of view, the outcome is rather than the mind is able to disregard what is distracting us and push it away, the mind begins to care. There's a sense of care, a sense of tenderness, wakefulness, willing to be with ourselves as we find ourselves. And that naturally stabilizes the mind and brings it into the present. Because we're not trying to manufacture a present. We're understanding that by working with the breath in this case, we're entraining ourselves into the present. And when we discover the present, of course there's all this chaos, right? Because we have the momentum of our life and all of these things that we felt but haven't had time to feel. And as soon as you give it a gap, right, it's just like a a roaring waterfall of thoughts and feelings. That's a sign you're doing it right, not that you're doing it wrong. Because you've provided space in which you can feel how you feel. And of course, there's a backlog, given the way we have lived, and our often deep distrust of our own natural goodness. So you'll be happy to know that all of the great meditation technique books, manuals, going back to the 1700s or the 1200s or going back to India at the time of the Buddha, as soon as they start writing it down, they say, when you first start meditating, you start to work with your breath and you place your mind on your breath. And if you're doing it right, the first thing you experience is an unbelievable waterfall of thoughts and feelings. It's just like crazy. Anyone have experienced that in meditation practice? Yes? What's it like?
Challenging.
It's challenging. Well said. But what's most challenging is when you feel like, I'm no good at this. I'm doing it wrong. That I should be having no thoughts and everything should be peaceful, and what's the matter with me? So again, we have a more interesting way of working with how we find ourselves when there's a fundamental sense of trust and friendliness in our own natural sanity and goodness. And from that point of view, given that we've been, as we say, out in Colorado, rode hard and put away wet in our lives, when there's that quality of we've been pushing ourselves really hard this lifetime so far. And there's been wonderful things and difficult things, but the one thing we haven't done, most of us, I'm sure there's exceptions in this room, but most of us, the one thing we haven't done is this. So to sit simply in the present moment without a tremendous program or ambition to fix ourselves or do something perfectly or get it right or optimize ourselves, to just is an act of real tenderness and bravery, of fundamental respecting who and what we are. And given that, we start to get to know ourselves in a much deeper way. If we're fundamentally uncomfortable with ourselves or distrustful of who we are, then our attempts to be with ourselves, there's going to be just tremendous jumpiness that happens. So this taking a chance of working with our discipline from the point of view of tenderness, friendliness. And you say, well, mindfulness is about precision. You're supposed to be right on the dot all the time. You see me wagging the finger here? What's the matter with you? What's the matter with you? You can't keep your mind on what we're doing. So one of the things we discover when we start to practice, when we leave a gap, might be 10 minutes a day, when we start to practice is that we've been wagging our finger at ourselves for a long time. We all have different styles of doing that, right? But we're berating ourselves that way. So you hear that voice, and then because you have good instruction, you say, well, that's just a voice. So the metaphor for making friends with our mind is taming a wild horse. So if we think of our mind as a very beautiful, very frightened horse that's been run around a lot, there's been a lot of, You know, when you ride a horse, if you pull on its mouth, it harms its mouth, and it becomes shies easily. And if you use the crop, it's afraid a lot, and it'll run fast for you. It'll do that. But when you want to actually make friends with the horse, it requires a sense of touch, that you can't be on the horse. So when we're doing our sitting practice, we're actually dismounting the horse. We're not trying to ride our mind somewhere. We're trying to make a relationship. And the place, the way you make a relationship, you can trap a horse and force it to do something. You can do that. But this approach is not that. It has the quality of, first you give the horse a big pasture and it runs around, right? It's just because of its momentum and its sense of panic, and it doesn't know how to be with itself or you. That's good practice. So you're sitting there and swirly, 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 and your breath is there. It's like, you know this word, a longe line, when you're training a horse? It's a long rope that doesn't go to a bit or a snaffle bit or something like that. It just goes to a harness. But it's really long, so the horse can run in big circles, right? And the horse, you know how horses are? Their ear goes up and their eye gets big when they're scared like that. So you're sitting and your mind is running around with thoughts and emotions, all of that. And you have good posture, and your breath is a longe line that you're holding gently. You're not jerking on it. You're holding gently, and the horse is round and round and round and round. And then every once in a while, the horse actually stops and looks, right? And your mind calms down for just a, and then off you go again, right? We're off again. But as time goes on, if you hold your posture and the breath gently, that quality of tenderness and interest and appreciation and mostly care, then our mind and our practice develop a relationship not based on control. So the horse is not tamed yet, and we're not sure how to ride yet. That's fine, but something genuine has happened. Something powerful has happened. And over time, we can pull that rope gently and not too quickly. If you pull that rope in and say, okay, we're going to be absolutely mindful, the horse is going to freak out. That's too much, too fast. But when we have a sense of touch, right, comes in, and eventually the horse and your hand and the rope, you're right here. You can actually feel the horse's breath on your face. And the horse's ear is cocked towards you. And you're sitting there. That's mindfulness and awareness. Eventually you learn to ride that horse. But that's a different kind of riding at that point. It's based on tremendous appreciation for the beauty and goodness of that horse, as opposed to trying to, they say with broncos in the West, break the horse. Right? You break the horse. You can break the horse. But that's a different kind of riding. We don't teach that kind of riding here. It's too sad to do that. Break our hearts way too bad to do that. So that kind of friendliness really changes our relationship between thoughts and emotions. People often think that meditation is about minimizing or eliminating thoughts and emotions. And according to the great masters of the past, that's not possible, nor is it a good idea. It is true that when you settle down, the amplitude of our thoughts and emotions relaxes. That's a natural thing. But to regard them as a problem is to have sort of self-aggression. It's like saying, I would like the sea, but I don't want any wind and I don't want any waves. That's going to work out for me if I try really hard, right? Well, there are going to be calm days. There will be calm days. That's actually true when you're sitting there and not a whole lot going on. But meditation is equally powerful and equally valid when we have very strong emotions. We've had some investigation into that over these last 4 days. That as we have strong feelings, that's like riding that beautiful horse over rough ground. And we have rough ground in our lives, right? That's part of what it is to be a person. And sometimes we have lots and lots of thoughts. And that's like, there's a lot of weather when we're riding. But we can have fabulous posture and a tremendous sense of dignity and care. And that's really great meditation. We need to be able to ride when it's bad weather or rough ground. And we also need to be able to ride when it's beautiful weather on a smooth ground. So trying to... It is possible to control our thoughts through discipline, but it's sort of a temporary phenomena. It's sort of like a trick. It's like, yeah, you can do it. Having a tremendously close relationship with how thoughts arise is really helpful, because that means we are really feeling how we are as opposed to suppressing, right? So being right there on the dot, that's not a trick. So... the reason that thoughts and emotions are, we feel they're problematic, is they exacerbate our sense of inadequacy and lack of appreciation of who we are. As we develop that kind of appreciation, we don't feel like we're being defeated by emotions and thoughts. We're completely present with them. It's the way we communicate with our world. So ultimately, this image of a rider on a horse, where there's been a tremendous journey of going from a very fearful relationship to one of mutual trust and a sense of humor, that you've learned to actually go up into the saddle, and you can ride when it's driving sleet at night, and you can ride on a beautiful day on the flats. That image is not of an isolated meditator who's dwelling in peace as an alternative to their life, as a respite, but of someone who has made a journey of making friends with who and what they are and learning to appreciate their natural wisdom, tenderness, and bravery, and who is completely engaged in his or her world with an open heart and a great deal of curiosity. So I hope this little tour of my ranch from out west has been of interest. I use a Western saddle. You're welcome to use one of those English ones if that's what you have out here. It's all the same. So let's have a few questions or discussion. Anything you'd like to talk about regarding meditation?
Thank you so much for the lovely talk. Currently, I'm working in mental health, actually, and it's interesting when you mentioned about voices and hearing voices and recognizing that they're only voices. But I guess, like, the most common presenting hallucination in someone who's, let's say, lost control...
Yes.
Is hearing voices that are very powerful. And I'm curious to know what you think about that, if there are voices that are too powerful.
Well, we all hear voices when we're... Anyone have arguments or rerun arguments in your head? Hasn't happened, huh? No experience of that. So You're actually having a dialogue. You know, first I say, and the other. So hearing voices in our head is basically conceptual mind. And that's a natural part of who we are, even if you're trying to figure something out, right? Say, okay, so I'm going to move this column over here, and then I'll sum it up, and, you know, and, oh, no, I have to do that. You know, you're talking to yourself, literally. So that's a natural part of narrating what's going on. When you have voices in the sense of someone who has psychosis or something like that, that's not something that meditation necessarily is efficacious with. It's a whole different topic. And I've seen situations where meditation was contraindicated for people who were going through that because they have such a strongly, you know, such a powerful mental illness that they're not able to actually work with the technique in a healthy way. It just puts them in a sense of isolation that's even more scary. So I'm not a therapist, and I'm not trained in these things, so I'm just saying that should be looked at with slightly different perspective, and I'm not competent to offer that. There are lots of people who have thought about this a lot and know a bunch about it, and I commend you to the people I know, and they're not the only people, at Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. There's been a psychotherapy program there for all of 40 years now that has been based around meditation practice to various degrees, but also has really looked into how you work with people with extreme states of mind for whom sitting meditation is not helpful. So your question's a good one, and I'm not the right guy to answer it in depth. Yes.
Thank you very much. Can you talk about the difference between group meditation and doing it alone? Or
yes, absolutely. Okay. So over the last 4 days, we've been involved in sitting together in a group. And one of the qualities of doing sitting meditation is you get the yips. That you're sitting here and you say, well, I could just check my iPhone. So, or I could do this or get that. So there's a sort of, when you're meditating with other people, it's sort of like, this is what we're doing. There's a quality of relaxation that someone else is going to ring the gong. I don't have to worry about it. So it's a really wonderful way to begin a meditation practice or to go deeper in your meditation practice. The sense of community is powerful and useful. However, meditating on a daily basis, in other words, they like each other, these two approaches. Meditating on a daily basis becomes part of your natural flow of your life, that it doesn't have to be an hour or a half hour. You can meditate for 15 minutes or 10 minutes in the morning. You really do it. You sit up, you work with a technique, which we didn't go into in a lot of detail in this context, but it's not complicated. And you do it every day. And what happens when you do something every day is you get bored. And when you get bored, you actually start to discover mindfulness. So the novelty wears off, and you think, well, nothing's happening here. I'm just watching my breath, whatever. I've been doing it for like 3 weeks now, and I'll do it one more time. And okay. I thought I was going to get some results, but I'm just sitting here. Well, guess what? Mindfulness is called just sitting here. That's the definition of I'm just sitting here and I'm really present because my project fell apart. So daily practice really helps your initial project fall apart so you have an intimate relationship with being present, which isn't based on trying to get somewhere where you're not. It's kind of a crazy idea, right? If you want to be present, you're not trying to get somewhere where you aren't. You're trying to go from where you are to where you are. So both approaches, they have a different flavor to them. You have this tremendous support with a bunch of people, but it's an episode, or it's a week, or it's a weekend, or it's an evening sitting. And then on your own, there's a quality of bravery that, okay, I'm actually going to make friends with this force. And that requires consistency and willingness to sit when I'm sleepy, sit when I have a hangover, sit when I feel great, sit when I'm busy and I have to get somewhere. I'm going to do it all those ways. That becomes very powerful.
Thank you. Is this on? Is this,
okay. Yeah.
So I appreciate your Western perspective. and listening to that, it brought to mind a different perspective that I related to. And I grew up in South Florida, so I'm mm-hmm. thinking of hurricanes.
Yes.
And I'm using your description to make the same analogy where you're trying to stay in the eye of the storm where it's safe.
Where it's safe, you
like
say?
The eye of the storm. Everything's around it, but in the eye of the storm, you're safe. And it's calm. But
it doesn't actually work that way when you do it, though.
Well, I'm saying the idea of I don't want to sit still.
Right.
So when you do sit still, well, then you can't stay in the eye of the storm anymore. The storm will...
You're going to get all wet.
Right. It'll pass. It'll start to pass over you. But the thing is, so right outside the eye is the eye wall, and the eye wall is the strongest part of the storm.
Yeah.
So my question is, when you decide to stop trying to be in the center and the eye wall passes over you, how do you not get
up and
blown
walk
away.
Away.
Blown away.
Turn on the TV, open a brewski, and check your iPhone all at once. Right, the eye wall.
It's exactly the strongest
right.
part of the storm. So, right, so it's how you don't want to have the roof of your house fly off.
Blow off.
You want to be able to stay.
So that we have that kind of blackmail that we use on ourselves to say, well, if I actually feel how sad I really feel, the roof would blow right off my house. And interestingly, there's a point in most people's meditation where you're actually feeling the kind of tenderness you spent your life hoping not to have to feel. Sometimes there's a lot of drama around it, but a lot of times there's not. And that's when your practice goes more deep, sense of commitment goes more deep, because you realize that the process of insulating yourself from this heart of ours will consume your life and all the resources of everyone around you. It takes an infinite number of resources to insulate yourself. And there's this quality of having practiced for a while and you actually say, someone said to me, I want to go all the way with this. So it's not all the way to some other destination. It's a sense of, I'm done with running. I really am. I'm willing to get wet. And that's why in Shambhala we call meditators warriors. In Tibetan, warrior means one who is brave. The word is power in Tibetan. And it's brave enough to feel. So most all of us have found ourselves numb. And when we do something as simple as being present without an occupation other than our attention on the breath, we start to care about how we feel, and there's no bottom to that. There's no bottom to it. It sounds like sort of a petty thing. Oh, I can feel the air conditioner on my face, and I can. But once you take that chance of feeling, and you're quite right, you're going to have to care in every direction. There'll be no edge to it. That's our path.
It's interesting that you mentioned numbness, because just today I felt the opposite of numbness.
Good.
I feel very physically exposed, and it's a little uncomfortable.
Yes.
It's almost like I've been sunburnt or something, but not exactly. That's not the entire analogy, but very unnerving, and it's a little uncomfortable.
Yes. That's because you're practicing well, that we feel, it's talked a lot about in the texts, you know, your sense of feeling exposed, raw, unprotected, vulnerable. And that's a little scary and a little uncomfortable, not in a crazy, jumpy way, but it's like, wow, this is... So, you know, it's sort of truth in advertising, right? Say, oh, if you meditate, you're going to be better at your job. You won't make wrong turns when you're driving. And everything's going to be cooler and you won't forget things and you're going to be optimized. No, you're going to be raw and you're going to care very, very deeply. And you're going to make friends with that horse. You're going to make friends with that horse. It's going to be a little scary for the horse and a little scary for you. That is a path worth treading. Yes, indeed. Thank you so much for your kind attention. And I'm going to go home and watch The Good Wife. Season 4. Just kidding. I do like The Good Wife, by the way. Thank you so much.
Told you. Hey, visit us at nyshambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. Come see our weekly Dharma gathering every Tuesday night. It's happening at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person. If you happen to live in a different city or be in a different city other than the New York City metropolitan area, then look us up. There's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Meantime, tell your friends about the podcast. Keep listening. Spread the word. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, random observations. And thanks for listening. Later.